Okay. We have enough people to start the committee meeting. And again, we're continuing with agency overviews at this point, and we have Arnush today. With us today is we have the Department of Revenue. And the Commissioner Arnus, you want to...
Hello, Madam Chair. My name is Ward Ines with the Department of Revenue, and this is my colleague, Commissioner Dan Salamone. And I thought the first we'd start out with going through a PowerPoint presentation, which I think you all have a copy of, or maybe not. Here, actually, it's a copy.
I think we do.
Oh, you do? Okay. Okay, so we actually got them here. I thought I'd have Mr. Salamone go through a PowerPoint presentation that'll give you a pretty good overview of the agency, our revenue sources, our primary initiatives, integrated tax, compliance initiatives, and then we can take any questions during the course of the presentation for that prepared prerogative.
Madam Chair,
Salamone.
My name is Dan Salamone. I'm Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Revenue. I'll try to give you a high-level overview of what we do in revenue. I want to be respectful of time, but I think we have a fair amount of time here, so we can do this at hopefully a leisurely pace. If you have the handout with you, I'll simply mention that our mission, as you see on the bottom of the first page, is to make the revenue system work well for Minnesota, and that seems like a fairly short and simple statement, but I can tell you it was a product of a lot of discussion in revenue as we got together to try to capitalize what it is we do. And making the system work well for Minnesota has a lot of attributes and aspects to it that I'll talk about as we go along. Our vision, very simply, is that everyone pays the right amount of tax, no more or no less. So we try to be balanced in terms of dealing with our taxpayers that they've overpaid. Obviously, we want to take care of that. The department has six goals that aren't shown on the slide, but we want to achieve taxpayer compliance. We want to inform our citizens of their obligations to file and pay taxes. We want our customers, the taxpayers, to be satisfied. We want to achieve a level of operational excellence, which is important. And we want to be responsible stewards of the data entrusted to us. We also want to ensure that our employees have all the tools they need to do a good job at tax administration. If you look at the page two, top of page two, there's a nice little diagram that reminds us that we're in the compliance business in the revenue department. And there are many aspects to compliance, and we kind of view it as a circular process. If you look at the diagram, you'll note that, and you can start just about anywhere on that wheel, but if you start with the top of the text there, interpreting the law, our responsibility is to inform taxpayers of their obligations and help them understand what they need to do. That's an important part of what we do. We then also provide taxpayers with the services they need and the information they need to meet their obligations. We're putting a lot of emphasis nowadays on electronic services. We are the number one electronic filing state in the country. We're very proud of that. And we're always looking for other ways to satisfy taxpayers' needs using electronic services. We process returns and payments. I'll have some data there for you in a minute. We issue a lot of tax refunds, and we manage taxpayer accounts, much like a bank would, keeping track of what taxpayers have paid us and what they owe us and so on. Obviously, not all taxpayers are compliant, and to various degrees, they may need a little encouragement to become more compliant. So we do have a very robust audit function in the Revenue Department to resolve any discrepancies, to discourage tax evasion, and to identify levels and patterns of noncompliance. Often there are sort of ways that you can identify, try to identify patterns of noncompliance that would suggest maybe certain strategies for the department in terms of improving compliance. And finally, we think it's important to recommend improvements in the revenue system to the governor and to the legislature as we see them. And so we complete the circle by making our expertise in tax policy available to policymakers, as well as doing all the administrative work that's involved in making sure people pay their taxes. I mentioned some statistics. If you look on the second slide on page two, $3.6 million individual income taxpayers are serviced by our department, 165,000 withholding taxpayers. These would be employers. 711,000 property tax refund claimants, 8,000 professional tax preparers we interact with on a regular basis, 277,000 businesses that collect and remit sales tax, 191,000 corporations and other business entities that we have to work with, 50,000 fiduciary income taxpayers. So you get a flavor of the volume of taxpayers that we interact with on that slide. Page three, on an annual basis, we provide forms and instructions to over 4 million taxpayers. We process over 9 million filing and paying transactions, answer over 635,000 phone calls. We conduct annually roughly 116,000 audits, and we assess over $300 million on an annual basis. And of course, we respond to a large number of email inquiries from taxpayers. Now, we talked about the wheel of compliance, if you will. We do make a distinction, though, between direct compliance and less direct compliance. Although it's a continuum, there's the point at which you have on the continuum a relatively small amount of activity in terms of compliance, and then on the other end you have a very direct and a high level of activity on compliance. And the distinction is really the extent to which you're providing support as opposed to actual compliance activities. So you'll see that on that slide that we sort of distinguish the various divisions of the Department of Revenue into these two categories. One category is direct compliance activity, and these would be the hardcore compliance activities, the collections, enforcement of the tax, our corporate income tax division, our criminal investigations division, our income tax division, petroleum division, property tax, sales and use, special and withholding tax. All of these tax divisions are very actively involved in collecting taxes and doing all the processes and steps I talked about when we were looking at that wheel. And on the right-hand side...
Thank you.
That's been fun.
Unless you want me to wait till the end.
Oh. But if they get too intrusive, we'll stop. But.
Okay.
I prefer them as the, I kind of prefer it. If you don't, you guys don't object, I prefer it as we go along.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick question for either of you. In terms of the compliance, does this include services dedicated to not just collecting taxes, but taxpayer questions? A business calls up, small, medium, or large, or a person calls up. And has a question about how something operates. Is that included within this? And then my second question, just to save time, is I know at one time you had a, I think you called it the taxpayer advocate position or an ombudsperson. I think it was called taxpayer's advocate at least a few years ago. Do you still have that?
We do have that.
Yeah.
I can try it.
Sure.
Madam Chair, Representative Simon, the question about whether taxpayer support services, answering questions, answering queries, would fall under the compliance support side of the equation. The compliance, address compliance, is really audit functions, collection functions that really directly lead to the collection of revenue. The support side is taxpayer information, taxpayer education. We do workshops to educate, you know, people starting a new business. So that would fall on the compliance support side of the equation of the department. And to your question regarding a taxpayer advocate, yes, we have a taxpayer advocate. We currently have four individuals in that office. We've actually had to expand that. We actually added one individual to that office. We've seen an uptick in recent years in the number of people who are utilizing the taxpayer advocate office. I think it's a function of the economy. There's probably the number of audits we're doing. We've done an uptick in the number of audits, probably due to the compliance initiative that we'll talk about in the later part of the presentation, but we have actually, it's a very important part of our department, the taxpayer advocate. It's a four-person office, but it's very important from our perspective for taxpayers to have an advocate within the department that knows how to navigate the agency, knows who to talk to, knows how to just kind of be an intermediary for taxpayers. And for the vast majority of people who utilize that office, the issue is resolved through the taxpayer advocate's office. So it's a very important part of the agency.
Thank you, Madam Chair, to that question. There's a reason why my phone is out and not off. It's because I think this goes to Representative Simon's point, but to a bill that that I've introduced that will is scheduled to be heard on Thursday in Chairman Pawlowski's committee on requiring the well, you have listed on the first slide on page 3 the 650,000 phone calls, and it's an astounding number. And I've had constituents contact me and you know, ask for how do I get an answer to my tax question, and it can take a little bit of time for us to find the phone number to get a live human being on the phone. And I know that when they do, I've actually asked them to call me back, and they say yes, that was the right way to get answers. But my bill, House File 1018, will require all state agencies on the website to conspicuously post an email and a phone number on the front page of the website. And I just, on the front page, there's not one, and then on the contact us page for the Department of Revenue, there's not a phone number. So just your thoughts on how do people actually end up engaging in the phone, or initiating the phone calls, and then your thoughts about it continuing to provide more easier opportunity to get a hold of the department.
And Madam Chair, Representative, during tax filing season, which is now, we try to be more prominent about the contact numbers, and also try to encourage people to use the web, so an email or something like that. We did a couple of years ago, when I first came on board, we reinstalled the toll-free numbers. So at one point, due to a cost-saving measure, the department discontinued the toll-free number. We heard from constituents, and the reality is a lot of folks out there don't have access to a computer, and they want to be able to make a toll-free number to ask a legitimate question about complying with our tax law. And so we brought that back, and we have different toll-free numbers depending on the tax type you're interested in. And so we try to prominently display that. It's in all of our regional offices on the door. So if somebody comes to one of our regional offices, the numbers and the contact information is available there. We need to probably revisit it. If it's not prominently displayed in our web page, it needs to be. And I'll take a look at that, but that sounds like a very reasonable piece of legislation to introduce. But we've tried to upgrade our availability. I think there was a push a few years ago within the department to try to drive more folks to the website and try to maximize electronic filing, which is a good thing. At the end of the day, we want to maximize, as Mr. Salmon says, we're number one in the nation. We always fight it out with Iowa for the top 5% number of percent of electronic returns, and we're about 72-73%. But I think we had overcompensated in trying to drive traffic. The reality is we're here to serve all taxpayers, whether they have a computer, whether they want electronically file or don't want electronically to file. So we tried to recalibrate that balance and say, here's a toll-free number, pick up the phone, talk to us, or alternatively, use the web if you have that technology available to you. So, and a lot of that feedback came from taxpayers and from legislators who had heard from folks that we had gone too far towards trying to encourage, you know, web access exclusively. So I think we're trying to recalibrate that, and any suggestions you or anybody else has, we're always looking at that.
Commissioner, your comments led right into a question I was going to wait, but since you went right at it, one of the constituents that I spoke with was somebody who doesn't use a computer, doesn't e-file, has about $50,000 of revenue for his home-based business, and got the notice of sales tax payment due on February 2nd, and I think the due date was either the 4th or the 5th, I can't remember, but it was, Commissioner Tomone, the furrowed brow was my response on the phone, too, was, I'll ask. And so I'm not asking specifically, but just that, you know, as we do the push to e-filing, his conspiracy theory was that we're trying to get a penalty for late payment. I told him, you know, I'll advocate for his behalf individually, but I think generally just seemed like something that if we're going to make those notices, the deadline gets pushed back I understand the difficulty with mail and processing internally, but it seems like that 27% we made it a little tougher for them. We don't want to lose them.
Madam Chair, Representative, And that's the calculation we have made as well, that everybody deserves the same level of service, whether they're going to file electronically or not, whether they're a more sophisticated taxpayer or not. So we need to, we try to do a better job of reaching out to those populations. We know we make the forms available at libraries and other places where people congregate. So if they don't have a computer where they can download, they can go in and get a hard copy. We found that there's a more new Minnesotans, immigrants moving in, that may not have a computer access to that kind of technology. We've done more outreach on our VITA site. These VITA sites volunteer. We have a volunteer site where you come and do your tax returns. We have interpreters at those. We're trying to get people compliant as they move into the state. People oftentimes are skeptical or even suspicious of government officials, especially tax collectors. They have maybe come from a country where there wasn't a tax collection system like our own, so they're suspicious of turning over information and that kind of thing. So we're working in our VITA sites and other ways to try to, you know, access that population, make sure they're in compliance. But it's a constant effort, and the landscape out there is constantly shifting. And but you're right, that 27% that still is not electronically filed, we're going to encourage them this time, but we're not going to force them. There's been some proposals that have been talked about requiring people who paper file to have an extra charge attached to that, and I think that's the wrong way to go. I think at the end of the day, there's always going to be a part of that population that is just resistant to electronically filing. That's their prerogative, and we need to process them with the same speed and professionalism as we do electronically.
Madam Chair, perhaps an extra, for the rather than a stick but a carrot for those of us who would e-file. A couple of, if we can work out something with Facebook where on Scramble I can get a couple of extra word hints for e-filing, just kind of throwing it out. That way I can be Representative Simon when we play the
Scramble. Yeah. Okay.
Continuing on the bottom of slide 3, talking about the divisions, and they're very directly involved in the compliance effort. On the right-hand side of that slide, we show the various areas of the department that are involved in compliance, but in a support role, providing the infrastructure. And we put in that category our legal and appeals division, our commissioner's office, obviously, communications division, financial management, human resources, our information systems division that handles all of the IT issues, tax operations, which is the actual physical processing of tax returns, and both returns and payments, and then finally tax research. And if you are on the tax committee, you know you get a statement from our tax research division about the impact of a proposed tax law change. That's a very important role that we play.
Madam Chair, would you mind if I just ask a couple of questions about some of these topics, because I know we're going to get to part about reduced number of FTEs and where the cut comes from. We just want to understand these things a little bit more before we get there. When you say appeals and legal, I assume you have sort of an administrative appeal process internally, and I know I'm jumping ahead, but if you are going to be reducing FTEs in that area, is it expected that you'll have an impact on the speed of appeals or the ability of people to use that avenue? Or how are you going to handle that, or will it affect it, I guess?
Madam Chair, Representative Winkler, you know, we have this bifurcated in compliance and compliance support. It's a less than perfect bifurcation. There's blending between these divisions, but as a general rule, most of the cuts to the agency will come from the compliance support side of the equation, which is the administrative appeals side. We will continue to have an administrative appeals division. It's an important for the taxpayer to have an ability, very cost-free ability to appeal an assessment. So we will have that. Our goal is to do those in, you know, quick as possible, expedite them. There's always a risk, though, if the cuts go particularly deep, that there'll be delays in that. We would never think of eliminating that function altogether and requiring people to go directly to tax court, but there is always the possibility that there'll be delays. The thing is, it's a very effective process in weeding out discrepancies between taxpayers and department. Only a little over 2% of all the people who utilize administrative appeals ultimately take their issue to tax court. So it's a very effective way of mitigating penalties, addressing issues that were flagged on audit. So it would be a mistake for us and for tax court and others to not have that process. But to your point, Representative, it's possible there could be somewhat of a delay if we cut some of that.
Madam Chair, I guess related to that would be the communications and tax operations. But on the communications, is that primarily where the taxpayer education piece would fit in?
Madam Chair, Representative Winkler, yes. Educating taxpayer, putting out revenue notices when there's a change in interpretation. At the end of every legislative session, we put out a bulletin to taxpayers and here are the tax changes to be cognizant of. So it would be all those educational efforts that we make during the course of the year for taxpayers.
And Madam Chair, the final one I guess I'll ask about is financial management. I presume that is fits into the general category of following where the money is going. It may relate to some of the internal control issues that the legislative auditor has raised. And I guess comment on that categorical number, and if you see room in the agency to take funding cuts there as well.
Madam Chair, Representative Winkler, at this point, we are not making any cuts to that area based on the governor's recommendations. And our chief financial officer is actually in the room, Dan Ostick, and he can speak to his office in more detail than I can. But it's a fairly lean office, but I think they do a good job working with legislative auditor and maintaining the controls and the protocols in place. If you want to have him come up at some point and talk in more detail about that, I'm sure he'd be more than happy to do that.
Well, we don't need.
Yeah,
Madam Chair, we don't need to get into that. But I think, from my point of view, as we go through iterations of budget from the governor, from the legislature, et cetera, I think it's helpful not just to see the categorical, but also how the budget impact might affect services besides the taxpayer. Because that's, again, in these times, that's a very important piece. That's a very important interaction between the state and the citizen is how they whether they can appeal, whether they're well informed about what those tax changes or rules might be, et cetera. So I think it'd be nice to see sort of more substance on service levels based on budget proposals.
Mm-hmm. On page four, there's an important message in the top of page four. We talked about direct compliance and the less direct compliance activity. If you look at the situation in the 2000-2001 biennium, 52% of our department's resources personnel were in direct were in compliance support activity. And in 2010 and 2011, we're projecting 33% compliance support. So the level of compliance support has been going down relative to the more direct compliance activity, and it's a direct result of compliance initiatives that the agency has received starting in fiscal 2002, where we received a given amount of money from the legislature. With a promise to return a certain additional amount of revenue to the state. And having, when we had those directives from the legislature, we've been restricted to applying those resources to the more direct compliance activities, less to the support end. So over time, we've had this shift, which at some point will become more difficult to deal with as, if we continue down that path. So it's an important change in our department in terms of how we operate with the relatively less support than we've had historically for some of the compliance activities. It's manageable at this point, but something we're watching as we move forward. On the bottom of that slide, if you're interested in our FTE, there's some history from 96 through 08, and you'll see that starting in 2002, you'll see a rise in our complement, our FTEs. That's primarily starting in 2002, primarily a result of the compliance initiatives that we have had. In the earlier years, the reductions were more a result of shifting priorities, moving into more use of technology, so that made it possible to reduce some of the FTE in the early years. So that's an important a trend there. You can see how.
Madam Chairman, Mr. Salamone, as I look at the bottom slide on page four, I suggest, it's just, I want to be clear because I think this is what you're saying, but essentially the total FTEs, both in support and in compliance, would be going down, but for these additional compliance initiatives that we have passed. And I think the pie chart showing 33% to 67% in support versus compliance, a third, you could divide the 67% probably in what, maybe another 25% or something that really goes into new compliance initiatives. It seems like we're cutting back on on FTEs going to the traditional functions, but we're adding and bolstering in a separate area. Is that a particular summary of what we're doing?
Madam Chair, I'm not sure what you mean by traditional function. Talking about compliance function?
Well, I guess what I'm saying is all those functions other than the additional compliance initiatives that we've paid for in order to bring more revenue back in.
Yeah. There's certainly been a shift in that direction.
Have we looked at, we have this strong analysis about what happens, and it's obviously kind of worked. What happens if we increase the compliance effort to work on doing that, and it's still paying back more than a one-to-one basis? Have we ever done that analysis for the support functions?
In terms of the ROI on support?
In terms of the return on investment on support.
Madam Chair, I think the problem with that is that the direct compliance is much more tangible.
Yeah.
You hire an auditor, he goes out and generates X amount of revenue and audit, you can book that. You hire a collector, they generate X number of money, you can book that. Now, how do you measure an informational notice to a taxpayer and what that actually generates? So I know legislative auditors came in when we did one of the first rounds of compliance initiatives and audited our methodology for booking the revenue, whether it was legitimate, and it was legitimate. We were given a legitimate methodology for how we were booking the revenue. But I think that's the problem. It's a good question. There's certainly revenue impact when you cut the compliance support side of the equation of the office. There's no question. It's just very difficult to measure it. It's much more intangible and amorphous. So we haven't tried to do that. This pie chart is telling, and the one below it on page 4 of Senator Winkler, you're right. The growth in the compliance side of the function, I would say, is two things. It's a function of the compliance initiative where the legislature has said, here's an appropriation, go out and hire collectors and auditors, and we may book a certain amount of revenue. It's also a function of us doing more automation, automizing different systems, more e-filing. We don't have as many people moving paper around the office. So it's a combination of modernizing our system and also the numerous compliance initiatives that's undertaken since 2002. So it's kind of a twofold impact that has changed the pie chart.
Thanks, Madam Chair. And maybe I missed it. Did you mention what the return on investment is for collections or enforcement, for lack of a better term?
Madam Chair, Representative Simon, and it's something worth talking about because the first compliance initiative yielded an ROI of about 10 to 1. And since that time, the ROI has come down considerably. The last one we did, we were tasked with a compliance initiative in 2008, a one-year compliance initiative, and the ROI we booked for that, I believe, was 3 to 1. So you gave us $7 million, and we were supposed to book $21 million. Now, that's a little bit of an atypical one because usually our compliance initiatives are biennial. So we only had 1 year to hire collectors, train them. So it was more constrained compliance initiative. The blended average over all these compliance initiatives, I think, is about 6 to 1. So there's still a positive ROI. It's above 1 to 1. But it's come down significantly. And I think the one caveat we have now is in this economy where we're seeing a real drag on even our traditional compliance effort and our collection effort. What could we actually book if we did another compliance initiative? And that's an open question right now, but it's uncharted territory here, I think.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I know it's very tempting for us, especially at a time like this, to think of collections as sort of low-hanging fruit, something that we could easily do. I know there was a candidate for governor a couple of years ago, actually, that I remember saying, there's $1 billion in uncollected taxes, so this person booked that entire amount towards, and it was a person in my party, I have to say, who booked that entire amount. Well, there's $1 billion in uncollected taxes, so that's going to go to X, Y, and Z. And we all know that you can't do that, and that was unrealistic. I'm wondering, though, I'm interested in that area. That sounds like a pretty good return on investment to me. And I don't know what the historical average is. I'm wondering, do you... can you share with us? Do you have? Are there?
There's a table at the back that gives you the tax compliance initiative summary.
Page 9, I think I might.
Oh,
maybe
it's
a slightly different version.
Okay, I can look. That
okay,
might. I don't want to take up committee time, but I do have one question. It's just a follow up. Do you? Are there incentives involved for people at the Department of Revenue? In other words, if you collect this much, you get a bonus or not? I know that's not typically been the case in years past, but are there incentives like that?
Madam Chair, it's actually a good question, because there actually was a bill introduced last year that would have provided an incentive based on the amount of revenue you generated as an auditor, and we have strongly opposed that. That we think is the wrong example for the auditors. We have a very committed group of audit staff in the field. It's one of the toughest jobs, probably the toughest job in the department, to be a field auditor. And we look at performance on a whole litany of ways, you know, taxpayer service, professionals, and everything. And we think that just to put some sort of bounty out there, tax bounty, would certainly send the wrong message and would conflict with kind of our motto, is that everybody pays the right amount, no more, no less. And we just want to give a fair assessment of people's tax liability. So the question's a good one. It's come up before, but there is no incentive or, I don't know what you want to call it, a contingency payment.
What if we backed off that one step? And I wonder if your bill would cover this specifically. What if I agree with your position? I agree with your position in not giving your employees a bounty. But what if we had a bounty system working on the outside of people who reported people for someone not in the revenue department to report someone, and then you do a compliance initiative and it turns out to be successful, giving them a percentage of the cut?
No, Madam Chair, that's not something I've ever really contemplated. I will say this. Our tip line is by far our more lucrative source of information regarding criminal investigations and audits. And if we get a call from a disgruntled spouse or an ex-employee, we always pursue those. So those are really, really usually very, very informed.
you could do a little experiment by giving them a percentage of the take and see what happens with that. Maybe with that.
Hey, Madam Chair, I don't know if...
You think vengeance is better than culpability?
They might be overzealous in there.
Well,
in their
I don't get it unless you collect them. So, okay. Representative Holbrook, did you have some?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I do have, as long as we're talking about compliance, every year when I get my taxes done, I've been using the same preparer for over a decade, and he shares with me his trials and tribulations of the previous year when I go into...
And this is the first time you've been on the committee to act on them.
Well, I'm not so sure I need to act on them directly, but I'm just curious, what kind of training do you give to the field workers? How long? And in one instance, he told the story of one of his clients that had spent weeks preparing all this documentation and had it all organized and set out in his garage, and an officer came and basically within an hour said, "Well, if you give me $1,000, I'll just go away." And that was, there was no like going through all the pages and everything. And I'm assuming that's not typical. But so how? Tell me, if you come into the department and you're going to be going out to people's businesses, what kind of educational background do you generally have, and what kind of training?
Madam Chair, Representative Holbrook, for the most part, we have RTS is what they're called, and they usually have accounting background. They usually have some kind of business background, for you know, some kind of education or business background. But accounting is primarily a 4-year degree. Go through a fairly extensive. Training program. We put a high emphasis on training. Ideally, we'd like to have them go out initially with an experienced auditor, trained with an experienced auditor in the field, that's become a little more of a challenge just because of this compliance initiative, and we're under a lot of pressure to get these auditors, a little more pressure to get them out in the field than we have been in the past. But they frequently have a senior auditor on when they first go out and do their initial audit, kind of learn. And, you know, being a good auditor is much harder than science. And it's really about knowing when to push, when to pull back, you know, that sort of thing. So it really takes time to become a good auditor. There's no question about it. The best test at the end of the day is just getting out in the field and doing the audit. And so we encourage our folks to call back to a supervisor, a more experienced field auditor in the office. If they have any questions about proper protocol, about proper interpretation, so oftentimes you'll be a field auditor and there'll be frequent calls back to the office to make sure they're doing it right. So we do our best on that. I will say the compliance initiative has been a challenge in that respect because we have a certain timeline where we're being expected to book X number of revenue in a biennium or maybe only a year. And so we try to fast track the training. We don't try to cut corners by any means. We strongly encourage collaboration among auditors. Oftentimes bouncing an idea, a fact pattern in audit you see haven't seen before off another auditor is always a good thing. And that's why I also think the administrative appeals process is very important. Because if there is an interpretation on audit, maybe that an experienced audit didn't quite get it right, or the administrative appeals process is a cost-free option for the taxpayer. You don't have to need an attorney to do it. It's a matter of right to get the administrative appeal. The administrative appeal has people who are very experienced field auditors looking at it to make sure we got it right. And 98% of those are resolved and never go to tax court. So that is kind of the fallback. But we do our best, but it's a challenge. There's no question about it.
And Madam Chair and Commissioner Ines, you said work with a senior auditor on one or two audits for a period of 6 months. Kind of what's the range on that?
You know, it depends. It depends on the complexity of the audits and how many they can get out in the field. Ideally, we'd like to do is send a new junior auditor in a field audit with a senior auditor, but even more than one senior auditor. So there's different ways of navigating an audit. And experienced auditors all have a different way of a style and a different way of doing it. And we encourage them to go out with different senior auditors to kind of get a feel for different practices, how people, everybody does an audit a little bit differently. And you can adopt best practices from all these different senior auditors. So that's the ideal. And that's kind of what we'd like to do. Sometimes, especially when it's most recent compliance initiative, only 12 months, we didn't have the option to go out there and do extensive audits with a senior auditor present in the field. And so maybe they only got, you know, a couple weeks out of the field with an audit. But usually, there's a lot of collaboration in the field as well. I mean, people do collaborate a lot. But it's challenging. It's challenging. I'll tell you, that the example he gave about the $1,000 is certainly not just the exception. That is an extremely rare occurrence. I really go to bat for our field auditors because they are very good, doing a very difficult job in very difficult circumstances, especially in this economic environment. And so I'm very defensive towards our field auditors. Not to say we don't make mistakes, not to say that there's times when our taxpayer service isn't what it needs to be, what it should be, but we have zero tolerance for that. That's immediate termination. And we have zero tolerance for the taxpayers not being treated with utmost respect. We don't always get it right, and that's why we have our appeals process.
If I might, without revealing any big, deep, dark secrets of how you choose to audit people, just in general terms about what percent are just random and what percentage are triggered by a particular characteristic of a return or a behavior with an individual or business.
You know, Madam Chair, Senator Holbrook, I can't give you a lot of detail at this time, but we do have a data warehouse which has a bunch of information where it helps us identify potential audits that may yield a good return. One thing we don't want to do is go out and conduct a no-change audit. No-change audit, essentially, I go out and I audit Representative Holberg. No change in the audit. It wasted your time, wasted our time, no revenue for the state. So we do our best to drill down and determine where there's going to be a change audit, whether it's for the taxpayer's benefit or our benefit. So that's what we try to do. I will say that there's been, I would say more often in recent years, we've had too many no-change audits. We're doing our best to eliminate those. So those are not a good use of our resources or the taxpayers' resources. Part of that's a function that we're just doing a lot more audits. And that's just part of the function of your compliance initiative.
And then, Chair, then from your response, am I to surmise that You do very few, just random audits.
Yeah. Madam Chair, I'm sorry, Representative Holbrook. Yes, very few random audits.
Okay, and then just one, if I might, one additional question, Madam Chair. Commissioner Ines, legislation was passed last year that required withholding for subcontractors. It caused a lot of consternation and pushback from the business community. Can you give me any feedback from your agency's perspective as far as compliance with this, what it's meaning for businesses, how it's working?
Madam Chair, Representative Holbrook, we have heard the complaints about compliance. I think part of it is a function of the economy being so bad and contractors being under extraordinary stress. But certainly a case. We are looking at the issues and seeing anything we can do to stand off some of the rough spots. But I do think the underlying legislation was well-intended and probably the right thing to do. And it really was an effort to put all contractors on a level playing field. Because what was really happening was there were people coming in, independent contractors, and maybe doing seasonal employment, leaving the state without ever paying any income taxes. So this is something the department has pursued for a number of years, to have some kind of withholding. We found that compliance, when you have some either withholding or third-party reporting, goes up substantially. You get 99% compliance net. And here was an area we identified as a high non-compliance. Those contractors are doing it the right way. We're at a competitive disadvantage. So we thought the underlying legislation made sense. It doesn't mean we can't revisit it and just see, you know, economic times are extraordinary. Is there something we need to do to address that? We put a grace, maybe a safe harbor in for a while, or a grace period. And so we're looking at that.
And Madam Chair, if I might, to Representative Kalon's issue about not having a phone number, I know just last week I had a question. We have a business and I had to do send in some sales tax due on the 20th or whatever, and I know I went to the website, went to sales tax, I didn't find the answer online, and the phone number was right there, and I think I only listened to happy music for maybe about 2 minutes before somebody got on the line and asked my question, so I was quite impressed with the service that I received, at least. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Dan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Follow-up on this kind of the effectiveness of the compliance activity, and there's kind of a diminishing return, it sounds like, but I'm curious, there's statistics in your budget that show this tax gap. And it's just a static chart, and it's from 1999. Have we, as a result of this increased focus on compliance, actually shrunk the gap? In other words, is the compliance of kind of a preventive ability, which would say, you know, maybe who cares if it's one-to-one, it's got a kind of a preventive value in it as well?
Madam Chair, Representative Downey, you know, the tax gap has been, we haven't done one recently. We are one of the few states that actually have done a tax gap analysis of this extent, and this was $1 billion that Representative Simon alluded to, that one of the gubernatorial candidates said, well, it's $1 billion out there, I can book that and solve all the budget issues. The reality is this budget gap represents a best case scenario. Everybody paid exactly what they owe, no more, no less. Everybody was compliant to 100%. This is how much more revenue we would raise. Now, the reality is Minnesota, we've done, other states have done gap analysis. We have one of the most tax compliant populations in the country. We have 90-plus compliance rate. Most of this noncompliance here is not willful noncompliance. It's people buying stuff on the internet, people buying stuff out of state, not realizing the use tax is old when they bring it into the state. The vast majority of the sales tax is not willful compliance. It's, you know, it's ignorant what the law is. So we have a very high level of compliance in Minnesota, and we're always trying to chip away at that. And we're in the process of doing some more gap analysis now, especially on the sales tax side of the equation. So we think that's where we can make the most inroads. We are we're a state that's instrumental in what's called the Streamline Sales Tax Project. That's a way to get a Supreme Court case called Quill overturned, in order for so remote vendors are required to collect at the point of sale. And the retailers are supportive of this, and that it puts the bricks and mortar retailers in the same playing field as the remote sellers, like the, you know, catalogs and the internet. So we've tried to make some progress in bridging this gap. But the reality is, as you all know, there's always going to be a tax
tax gap. And I would argue our gap is substantially less than most states. You know, the IRS did a gap analysis that showed the gap was, you know, something like 15%. So, relatively speaking, I think our gap is reasonable, but there's always a way to try to address it. And usually it's taxpayer education, simplification of law. That's why we always push for what we call federal conformity, because the simpler it is to comply, the higher the level of compliance there is. So there's tools out there to chip away at the compliance gap, but the vast majority of people aren't willful evaders of the law.
Commissioner, I think we gave you a copy of the article that we also passed out to members. It was in last week's New York Times on the travel sites to collect hotel taxes. Is this anything that you've been looking at? I guess you probably not as useful here as Florida and California in the winter, but is this anything that we've looked at?
Madam Chair, actually it is something that we've vetted both with our legal department in-house and with the AG's office about how to pursue this. If pursue, we've met with St. Paul and some other cities who are interested in this. It's to a large extent, it's the local option sales taxes too that are involved in this. There's a lot of litigation going around the country on this issue. And so to a certain extent, we were waiting to see how some of those court cases turned out before we dedicated resources to pursuing this. But it's something that's certainly on our radar screen and is a potential to generate some revenue. So far, the states have had a very mixed record at being successful at this, but maybe the tide will turn.
You're going to tell us how much we can book in this budget on this?
I have to get back to you, Madam Chair.
Right.
Madam Chair, Commissioner, I just looking through this article quickly. Are there lawsuits that Minnesota localities could join, class action types? Because I see Barron and Budd is the law firm representing them, which sounds like a class action to me. And you've got Skadden-Arps on the other side, which looks like the classic plaintiff defense kind of case. So I wonder if there's an opportunity for Minnesota taxing jurisdictions or the department, the state, I guess, to become one of the plaintiffs potentially.
And Madam Chair, Representative Winkler, there is actually a law firm in Minnesota that has been interested in pursuing this lawsuit. I don't know if they've taken any affirmative action, but I know they've met with some of the major municipalities in the state, and they've met with us regarding potential strategies, and potentially even contracting with the AG's office to represent the state. So I know there's a local firm that's interested. This is a class action lawsuit. And one thing we do have in Minnesota, we have a very good nexus law. This is a nexus issue, and we have a fairly strong nexus law. So the possibility is that we would be in a pretty good place to bring a class action.
All right, keep this in your folder, guys. Okay.
Madam Chair, on my page 5, possibly your may have a page off here, there's a slide entitled FY 2010-2011 Base Budget. It's just basically a depiction of the dollars that we receive for those fiscal years. You can see that our annual budget is $127 million. That's basically the agency operating budget. Those numbers do not exclude our special revenues that come in to administer, for example, the local sales tax option.
On those special revenue funds, is it a set percent, or given that we continue to underperform in certain areas in the transportation sector, do you get a percent off the top, or do you get actually an appropriation of a dollar amount?
Maybe our vehicle can answer that more accurately than I can.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, Representative. It is based on the number of transactions. I'm sorry, Dan Osick, Department of Revenue. It is based on the number of transactions. There's sort of a formula that is driven. So it's based on transactions and the number of people that, file, and then also the money amount. So the money amount is a third, and the transactions is two-thirds, and that's what the formula is driven on, so how much comes in.
And, Madam Chair, how would you define a gas tax transaction? Is that every supplier that... how do you do that with the gas tax?
Madam Chair, Representative, I do not deal with the gas tax in that local option, so I really wouldn't know. I can look for you and get the answer for you.
And Madam Chair, it sounds like it is that these are all based on a formula so that it's not a dollar appropriation but an estimate, so that I'm just trying to clarify that if some of these special revenue funds are underperforming projections, it could have a negative impact on your department's budget because you in turn would receive a reduction in funding as well. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. Somebody's buzzing.
If anyone has a cell phone on, they should turn it off. Even if should be turned off, even if it's on silent. Apparently, we get interference with something. Okay. Sorry, I should have asked it. So, okay.
Madam Chair, on the second slide, there's one entitled "Department Challenges," and I think this is an important slide to spend some time on. Revenue plate is relatively full, I would say, at this point in time. One of our biggest challenges right now, and one that's going well, is to complete what we call the integrated tax system. We'll be talking about that more as we go through the presentation. The integrated tax system is an entirely new tax processing system that is being implemented in the Revenue Department. It will be implemented over the next 4 years. Our challenges with this right now is to implement the installation of this new system while keeping the old systems running. So we're actually transitioning off of old systems and onto a new one. That currently involves upwards of 100 of our revenue employees taking time off of their regular jobs to participate in this project. I'll talk more about that as we get into the details of that project. Secondly, we have been worried a lot about the loss of institutional knowledge, not just the revenue. I think every agency is concerned about the coming retirement of the baby boomers. We estimate in the next 5 years we'll lose 1 in 5 of our leaders from the Department of Revenue. Our challenge is to have people ready to take those positions and to assume those leadership roles. So that's the 1 in 5 would be about 250 of our employees reaching retirement age in the next 5 years. So that is a concern of ours. On the other hand, we have a burst of new young employees coming in as a result of compliance initiatives. So the age distribution of the Department of Revenue is we have a whole bunch of young employees coming in on compliance initiatives and a whole bunch of old folks who are ready to retire. And so it's all kind of a U-shaped distribution of the age of population of a department. That's the challenge.
Would allowing a phased retirement be helpful at all for that? You know, we've done this sort of stuff for Minsky where the people can do a phased retirement without loss of their pension benefits, so that they keep.
I think the economic times right now may give us a little bit of relief in terms of the speed with which people retire. I'm sure there are more than a few employees that are reconsidering retirement. I'm one of them.
And Madam Chair, to that point as well, I think we have taken advantage of the post-retirement option that's available to bring back some folks who have unique knowledge. And we have one individual who does assessments of utility properties, very complex, very esoteric part of assessment practice, and there's probably 4 people in the entire state that have this skill set. So fortunately, we brought him back and on a post-retirement option. Hopefully we can find a replacement down the road, but we have taken full advantage of that option. So that's a good option to have, especially for some of those unique knowledge areas where it's hard to find a replacement.
Madam Chair, I just wonder if they could also comment on the overall reduction in FTEs, taking out the compliance, new compliance pieces that we've done since 2002. But overall, your FTE complement has been going down over time, and if it's getting older, the concern would be we're really not going to be in very strong shape. You know, the one person who's who is one of four who knows how to do his job, the way to do that, of course, is to hire somebody and then train them in how to do that, or, you know, maybe just magically find the right person. But the concern I would have is continuous declines in FTEs means, in addition to the baby boom retirement, you're not really filling in the skill sets and people anyway.
Yeah, good point. Yeah. Madam Chair, Representative, to that point, we have developed a fairly aggressive recently successor program. Like, well, we have a leadership academy where we try to earmark people we think could be future leaders within the department. And we take about 30 of them a year, and they go through a very, very intensive leadership academy. We have bring speakers in and try to hone their leadership skills. So we're cognizant of some of the challenges we're going to have down the road. I will say we're probably better situated than a number of agencies. I came from Deed, and we did a profile of our workforce. We had about 1,500 employees at Deed. Out of the 1,500, we only had 25 employees under the age of 30 in the whole agency. And so we were really under the gun as far as finding successors. And so I look at ours, and we have this hollowing out problem that Mr. Salmoni alludes to, but we do have a very ambitious group of young people who have entered the agency within the last 10 years who are up to the challenge of assuming those leadership positions. We strongly encourage folks to move around within the agency. So don't just, you know, necessarily be an income tax or property tax, you know, transfer within the agency, expand your portfolio, opportunities may come up, leadership opportunities. And so we do our best to try to earmark those we think have leadership qualities, train them, and do our best to retain them. I mean, we've cut back on some of those things we've used for help retention because of the budget challenges, but we had a very generous tuition reimbursement program, $6,000 a year. Was it $6,000 a year. For if you want to get your MBA or some other kind of training that's related to your work. We just continued that in the short term. We want to bring that back when the budget allows. The Leadership Academy is another thing. So we're trying to pull some levers, Representative, to try to train the next generation of leaders. And we have a mentorship program within the agency. People do a really good job of mentoring the younger employers. So it's a challenge. It's certainly a challenge. I think we're better situated than some agencies.
Madam Chair, but the you've also listed here that continued market competition for accountants is a problem. So are you training all these great new people just to leave once they hit the age of 29 and head out for the business world once the economy turns around?
And Madam Chair, Representative Winkler, that's an ongoing challenge. It's not as a challenge today that it was 2 years ago or a year ago. It has been a challenge. We bring folks in, we train them, maybe they go get their CPA on using our tuition reimbursement, or and then they get wooed away by a CPA firm. You can't match the salary. One thing we have done to mitigate that migration is that we entered an MOU with the Department of Employee Relations to give our auditors additional pay increases outside the typical union contract. It's an effort to try to retain them longer. We want to retain our best auditors. They're our most efficient auditors. They generate the most revenue. So we've entered in the MOU. We've re-upped that MOU a couple of different times. And it's been a helpful tool, especially when the economy was stronger, in retaining some of our talent.
Just final point, I guess, final question. So the concern is that in 5 years, we're not going to have the stellar Department of Revenue that we've had because these people are going to retire. The number of FTEs are going to drop. The people that are trained are going to move on. What level of confidence, I guess, do both of you have that we're going to be able to maintain this very high standard for a department in 5 or 7 years from now?
Madam Chair, Representative, there are some bright spots. We have a very robust training operation in the department. On any given day, it's hard to find a conference room. There's so many training sessions going on. The integrated tax system will make it a lot easier for employees to get trained and be trained in more than one tax step. They can migrate from sales to income. They don't have to learn the systems because the software is such that the processes are the same for every tax.
Yeah.
So there are some bright spots. I think it will continue to be a challenge and a worry, but we can point to some areas of in the department where we hope things will compensate for the rapid exit of the senior employees.
Madam Chair, Representative Winkler,
the Department of Revenue is a very, I don't know how to put this, but people have made their careers there, and they've made them there for a reason. We have a lot of people who have been 20, 30, 40 years within the Department of Revenue, and I think to a large extent that bodes well for the future revenue, because it's a place people feel comfortable working, it's got a good culture, it's challenging work. Many of them could make earn a much more a larger salary in the private sector, but they choose to stay there, and it's challenging work, it's public sector, there's a lot going for the department. We got to make sure we are still competitive in the areas we need to be competitive, that we still provide the training necessary. But I look at our department and the legal department, for example. We got a great mini law firm within the Department of Revenue, great expertise, and most of those people have been in the department more than 20 years. And a very marketable skill that go to any law firm with their expertise and their given tax types, with tax, sales tax specialists, petroleum tax specialists, great expertise, not duplicated almost anywhere. And they've stayed because it's rewarding work and a very good culture. There's a balance of work and personal life that maybe you wouldn't get in a law firm or an accounting firm. So we try to stress those things, and we value our employees, and we do everything we can to recognize those achievements. So I think on balance, it's a good place to work, and the longevity of our employees, how long they've stayed there, is probably proof positive of that. It's a good place to work, and we've got to maintain that.
Madam Chair, my hope would be that we continue to make the right decisions so that we can say 20 years from now we have a lot of 20-year employees here.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Madam Chair. And Commissioner, in regards to this educational and wonderful things, and you've shared a lot of good things about what you're doing, and that is a good thing, and I think that does step us in that direction for that kind of retention. However, one of the things, though, is when you do this kind of a special education program, they get their CPA or they do that, and it's great to do that. But in other institutions, entities such as military, I know, in the nursing and a variety of medical places, that if they do that for you, you also sign a requirement that you stay with that entity for a certain number of years for each year that you give them, so that you at least get something in return. And you can't keep them forever. Sometimes, you know, those things go in competition. But at least that you have kind of a minimum amount of time that they need to pay back for getting that educational benefit.
Madam Chair, Representative, no. I'm trying to remember if we have some sort of clawback provision in our tuition reimbursement. Okay. We do have a clawback provision. I can get some more details on that. If you leave at a certain point, you know, after getting the degree, there's a clawback of a certain percentage, and I'll pro rata over a certain period of time. But I can get that. So that was a concern for us. Mm-hmm. It was a very generous tuition reimbursement, and the challenge was, were people going to leave? My understanding is that we've, and I can check with our CFO, that we've very rarely had to initial the clawback provision. So I think most folks don't depart after gaining their degree. The challenge is more often these very young auditors that come in, and they do the 2 or 3 years, and they become a high-functioning auditor, and then the CPA firms come in. So usually those folks, taking advantage of tuition reimbursement at that point, they're still busy learning their job. But the CPA firms can come in and probably carry them pretty well, the talented ones, and give them a salary that we just can't compete with. The MOU has helped mitigate that concern, but it's still our primary problem, even those young auditors are just newly trained.
Okay. Keep going.
One other challenge that Commissioner's already alluded to, and I've already talked about the issue of compliance support, the balance of support versus their compliance. Commissioner talked about the challenge of serving a more diverse population. This is a real difficult thing for, I think, a lot of the agencies. I noted some statistics here in the year, between the year 2000 and 2015, the number of the Hispanic population will rise 98%, the Asian population 121%. And the African American population, 115%. And of course, there are lots of other ethnic groups that are maybe relatively smaller in numbers. It's our challenge to translate all of our text materials, instruction forms, and so on, into those languages, and that can be very expensive. It's also very expensive to have a telephone service where you have someone available to take a call from a non-English speaking taxpayer. We do that for, I think we do well with the Hispanic population, but for some of the other ethnic groups, we're not doing as well as we should be doing. It's a resource-intensive activity. So it's another one of those challenges that we just have to find a way to resolve.
To that point, the diverse population also, we've doing our best to get information out to them about the ease of compliance and encouraging them to electronically file and the like, that those populations are more prone to do loan anticipation refunds, which are not a good deal for the taxpayer. So we've been trying during the VITA site visits to emphasize the importance of using our electronic, filing electronically. Usually your refund back within 3 working days, 72 hours to get your refund back, rather than use one of these refund anticipation loans that have interest rates, you know, triple digits if they're annualized. So we're trying to access those populations and discourage them from going that route.
Madam Chair, just for clarification purposes, so set our time on this. We've got 15 minutes left, and we haven't started the integrated tax system. So I think we're going to ask, can you guys come back on Thursday and do the integrated tax system?
Sure.
And we'll do that, and that time we'll be sure we invite the revenue people, which we were supposed to, people on the tax committee, which we were supposed to do and didn't remember to. So so we'll do that, and we're also going to talk about the combinations between finance and revenue in the computer systems. And I think that'll give us a better orderly way of doing it. So we're just finishing up this page now.
Madam Chair and Commissioner Ines, so hypothetically, if instead of using one of these tax advance places, a young person maybe used their parents and they electronically filed a week ago but received advance money from their parents, when it's been about a week, they should be able to repay that money back? Hypothetically, of course.
Representative Holbrook, that is correct. In fact, I think there was a truck that wasn't here, but I know for electronic refiling, the turnaround, the average turnaround time is 3 days. If you're a paper filer, I think it's 9 days. So one of the primary virtues of electronic refiling is your refund comes in $5 or $7. So, yeah.
And like, what would be like be the most outside that we could expect, hypothetically, that electronic return would be direct deposited to a young person's 1040 easy form?
Madam Chair, Representative Holbrook, if you don't have anything in the bank account within a week, I would call the cut and we'll track it down.
Or if the lending entity didn't have any money in their hand within a week, they might want to contact their young person.
Madam Chair, Representative Holbrook, that is correct.
All right, thank you.
Okay. Representative, thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Holbrook. Hypothetically, if one did TurboTax, they received their state refund in 3 days, hypothetically. My question about Turbo is regarding TurboTax. It has become a very big phenomenon. In fact, I always had an accountant, and he retired, and so I decided that I'm going to do this, you know, hypothetically, one, if they didn't have an accountant, could do this on their own with TurboTax. And I found it very easy, but as I'm going through it, I kind of went into my legislator mode about how does that transpire? I hope we're not diverting too far off, but I think it goes to, are you having issues with more people using and doing the taxes on their own? Are you getting an increase in questions? Are you getting a decrease in questions? I mean, are you having issues with TurboTax, like if not receiving stuff? Or, I mean, maybe if you just want...
Madam Chair, Representative, we've had a great experience with electronic filing in general. And TurboTax is the kind of premier product out there, I believe, but there's a number of other vendors out there. We actually do our due diligence on different vendors, and we post a number of them on our website. And many of those actually provide free software access to those who have income levels below a certain level. So there's some folks in electronically file who can use that resource, and it won't cost them anything if they fall below a certain income threshold. As you know, TurboTax is pretty self-explanatory. I watched it through all the deductions.
In fact, we encourage people to use a product like that because you're much more likely to get the full advantage of all your deductions and credits because it really just walks you through and kind of spoon feeds you the information. So we're, at the department, are big advocates of many of those products, and the tax layer, there's a whole number of them. And we actually, they're very secure. One of the concerns we have is how secure is it electronically filed. But these vendors and the software products and our systems are extremely secure, so there's no risk to your information. In fact, there's less risk to your information going electronically than mailing it. So we strongly encourage it. I don't think we've had any uptick in the number of questions. In fact, I can check with our folks, but I would expect as electronically filing has gone up, the number of questions from taxpayers has probably gone down. That's an inverse relationship, I'd expect.
Just out of curiosity, with TurboTax, you know, you go to, you know, your regular store, buy it, and there's a fee on it. And then they also advertise on there that you get one free federal filing and then you pay for your state filing. Is that their service fee, or is that because something the state charges them to be able to be compliant with the state? I'm just wondering out of curiosity.
That's a good question. Madam Chair, Representative, we don't charge a service fee for filing. So okay. it would be an individual decision on the part of each software provider.
Yeah. Okay. Let's go to, again, leave the integrated tax system till Thursday. Let's go to page 9 and then the top of page 10 and do those three slides.
Representative Schiffmeyer,
thank you, Madam Chair. I believe, Representative Bingham, you kind of picked up on the thread of where I was going to on the free tax filing and some of those issues. So I think most of the questions that were asked here were covered, have addressed it sufficiently for now. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.
So, Madam Chair, are you looking at the slide that's budget change item number
yes.
2, agency budget reduction? Item 1 is the integrated, and we'll deal with that.
Thank we're going to deal with that later.
Thursday. Well, as you can see on the slide, we have a mandated reduction in the unallotment process of $2.7 million. That's fiscal year 2009. And that's calculated as our goal was to cut 10% of the compliance support unspent funds. So the compliance support unspent, 10% of that was our goal with that cut. And those dollars were calculated as of December 4th of 2008. I'll have a little more to say about that in terms of implications. And then for 10 and 11, our budget budget cut target was $8.26 million. And that's 10% of the agency non-compliance-related funding. So it's analogous to the 09 number, but it's for the broader category of non-compliance funding.
So your guess is, if you're following what happened in 09, is that this would have been unspent anyway, isn't it?
It was what we hadn't spent as of December.
Right, but for your 1 for 2, 10, and 11, that works on the assumption that it's going to follow the same pattern
forward.
As it did in 09?
Right. To carry forward in
okay. Right.
So the numbers are 2.7 and 8.26. We had communicated with employees that it was our best estimate that with these reductions it would lead to a reduction of 52 positions in the Department of Revenue. Now some of you may have heard a larger number that was reported, I believe, in the Tribune article, 134 positions. And that's sort of a worst-case scenario if you assume to get to the 134, you'd have to have a situation where there was no salary supplement and there were negotiated salary increases. If you had that combination, then we would be looking at the bigger number. Of course, we don't know how all that will play out, but our best guess right now is what we know are the 52 positions. And about 14 of those would be actual layoffs, and the rest would be reduced through attrition.
But if we were to do something like increase the compliance target, you could hire those layoffs to do that.
That certainly would be a possibility.
Okay.
In terms of the support activities affected by the reduction, support services, generally taxpayer information services, such as instructional services, employee training services, tax research activities, tax appeals and legal counseling services, taxpayer property tax oversight activities, and technology development, infrastructure investments, and infrastructure maintenance. So there will be a challenge here, but we try to allocate our cuts across the division in a way that is as least disruptive as possible. So there's a lot of interaction earlier in the year with our divisions on what we can do and still sort of have a base level of support for taxpayers.
What about this one at the bottom, the closure of state offices?
I think you must be on the next slide. Let me
I'm sorry, yes.
Okay. When we were confronted with the need to make these cuts, we had a lot of conversations internally, and we implemented as soon as possible a number of items. I mentioned the predicted layoffs. Other things on this slide, new hires are... We immediately put a restriction on new hires, except for those who were directly involved in compliance activities, sort of very direct compliance. So those were permissive hires. We also made an exception for any hires related to the work on the integrated tax system. That's our number one priority in revenue, and we didn't want to jeopardize that. We set in place an approval process. I personally sign off on all new hires. And if it's RTS, the commissioner talked about the revenue tax specialist, the auditors, that's pretty much an automatic hire, particularly if it's related to a compliance initiative. We reduced our job-related school funding, as the commissioner mentioned, tuition reimbursement. We suspended service awards and achievement awards. Achievement awards are basically lump sum increases one time based on merit, and those were suspended. We suspended managerial salary increases. We reduced agency membership dues. We're looking for ways to do that with all of the membership organizations that we are part of, the Federation of Tax Administrators, Multi-State Tax Commission, the Streamlined Sales Tax, the MSATA, the Midwestern State Tax Administrators, looking for ways to get those dues reduced. I mentioned service awards. That was probably one of the most contentious items. This is where, you know, you hit a certain benchmark in your state service and you get a pen and pencil set or something like that from the state. And so we put a suspension on that. We have closed some of our smaller offices around the state and those that we have in some other states. These are very small offices, usually a couple of two or three employees. And we basically have closed out some of those.
Dan, real quick, I'm sorry.
Sure.
The one except Rochester one may be of some interest to the folks on the committee. Rochester actually was a fairly sizable office. The building that they were been housing for many years actually had an environmental threat. We were diagnosed with pretty serious mold issues. So we made the decision to close that office, and initially we were going to find alternative space in the Rochester area. But we decided instead of doing that and incurring the upfront cost of getting a building in place and the lease payments, we decided to telecommute all those individuals. So there's about a dozen individuals now, both collectors and auditors, who are telecommuting. So that we still have a Rochester presence. Nobody lost their job because of that closure. But we decided it was a really good opportunity to pilot project the telecommuting of the collections. We've never done that before. We've done it for auditors. We've never done it for collectors. So it's been an unequivocal success. Many folks, it's a quality of life issue. One person was commuting more than an hour each way to work. Now she's just as productive as ever and working from home. And so it was actually an opportunity to experiment with some telecommuting issues and see if they worked, and they have, and so we can expand beyond that. But the Rochester office, we still have our same Rochester presence down there.
Okay. And there wasn't one of the arguments that we heard last time when we were telling you needed to expand it was a security issue on the computers, and you've managed to, these people, I assume, all have dedicated computers for
Is that the way it was handled?
With Madam Chair, it was. In fact, Terry Seamless in the room, she's the one that really took the plunge on having collectors telecommute. And so I'm going to give her a lot of credit. She's the one that came and said, you know, we should try this, we should experiment with this. But in order to do that, there's a security assessment done at everybody's home. So they got to have a dedicated computer that has all the appropriate encryption on it. You got to make sure there's a place where taxpayer information is going to be secure. But everything is done electronically online now. So as long as we have the encrypted laptop computer and all the other resources, we think it's as secure as if it was in our normal office.
I don't know what other state agencies this would be applicable to, but is there more talk about this in other state agencies? You know, when you're sitting in the governor's office,
you know,
commissioners sitting together talking.
Madam Chair,
yeah.
I'm not sure of how agencies are doing.
Okay.
I think we had a unique challenge.
Sure.
Just because of security issues, we take that obligation so seriously about securing taxpayer information. But I think we've resolved that issue, and we have very secure protocols in place, and I think for the most part, employees enjoy the option of telecommuting.
Okay.
But maybe one other point regarding that slide.
Okay.
I just want to make...
And what did some people ask what the New York office did?
And the New York was a very, as Mr. Thalmoy said, it was a very small office. The auditor is still out there, so we just don't have a separate dedicated space we're paying rent on. So we still have a presence in New York, we still have a presence in Chicago and Dallas. But we've been, more and more often, we've allowed those folks to tell us there's no reason to have a standalone office in all these states. So we're slowly going away from the offices in these outstate areas, out of state, and going to telecommuting. And all the things on the slide, I mean, when we got our marching orders regarding, you know, unallotment and our budget cuts for the upcoming 10-11 biennium, our number one goal was to maximize taxpayer service, obviously, not have an adverse impact on revenue collections, and mitigate any layoffs. And so eliminating the tuition reimbursement, the membership fees, the achievement awards, service awards, none of them were easy decisions, or good, you know, but they're the right thing to do if we really wanted to maintain as many of the employees as we possibly could. And this laundry list of things enabled us to do that.
Okay. And then the last one that we'd like some, we started to talk about it earlier, but the tax compliance initiative. And people talked about the decreasing return with the, any comments on that?
Madam
and at what point? At what point does the return get to one to one before we consider it too low, or what? At what point?
Well, Madam Chair, I don't think that's the only metric. I think there's other challenges within the department that have to be acknowledged as well, to determine whether this is still the right thing for the department. I remember the House 2 years ago, I believe, had a compliance initiative that was, I think it was giving us $100 million. So it would have, virtually increased our budget by 60%, 65%, and they wanted to net, $400 million. The reality is that would not have been in the best interest of the department or the taxpayers of Minnesota. I mean, we would have had an auditor in everybody's home. But I think we need to strike.
Is that cost effective or not to have an auditor
every income? I think there's a balance that has to be struck between having a very robust compliance presence at the same time as a tipping point as well that taxpayers probably won't tolerate at some point. And also just the operational impact of hiring that many new employees and training them and finding space for them and making sure they're adequately trained before they go on an audit. And if you're increasing your FTE allotment by hundreds of employees in a given year. I mean, the last biennium, when we did the compliance initiative, I think we hired close to 100 employees. That's a large influx of employees that need to be trained. And so I think there's other operational issues beyond what the ROI is. Some people say, well, as long as the ROI is greater than 1-to-1, let's just keep going to the well, But I think there's other concerns about the operation of the Department of Revenue, and there's a tipping point that I think ultimately will be reached. I don't know where that tipping point is yet, but we'll
find out as they get better trained and more experienced, does their return go up?
Madam Chair, absolutely it does. It does.
because that these numbers could be bigger without increasing any.
Because the baseline is the baseline, and we don't recalculate the ROI of the more senior auditors. So they certainly become more efficient and better auditors, but I don't know how you calculate that exactly.
Well, we don't have to calculate it. We just assume it.
Okay, another question.
Representative,
Madam Chair, I believe with the next meeting, my question can wait for that.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right. Okay, we now have the minutes before us. Representative, the minutes of February 17th. Representative Kissmeyer moves the minutes. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
It's accepted. And the meeting is adjourned.